Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of The Armchair Survivalist. My name is Kurt Wilson. I'm the Armchair Survivalist, and today is May the 30th in the year 2021. Welcome to the show. You want to find out all the different ways to listen to me? Go to armchairsurvivalist.com, scroll down all the way to the bottom of the page. You'll see all the different ways. I'm on every podcast venue that exists. I have archives on my website there you can look at. All right, I don't have a lot of time to talk because this is kind of an important show. So let's get some business out of the way for Survival Enterprises. We have our ham radio still, $50 and $75. These are portable handheld units. They're brand new. They work phenomenal. They're extremely inexpensive for now. It's almost impossible to locate these things now. There's a shortage because people are buying these up like crazy. We also have the Mountain House freeze-dried food in the Expedition Bucket, which is about a week's worth of food for $125. You come in the store and on Government Way in Hayden, Idaho, and you can pick them up for there for $125. We ship anywhere in the U.S. delivered $150, so it's a $25 shipping fee. I'll explain in a little bit why I have to be so quick here. Now, first off, sorry that I didn't tell anybody that I was going to be playing replays for a couple weeks. I'll explain that too. Right now, there's some information from the Ice Age Farmer that I think you guys need to have.
We are staring down the barrel, collectively, of a set of circumstances, each of which independently would be a major change to our way of life. And certainly throughout history they have been. But it is their confluence which now greets us. These three things I'm describing are the hyperinflationary scenario, where we've printed tons of dollars, but they're chasing too few goods. The global grains shortage, and now it's extending into proteins. We've got poultry shortages being reported in mainstream media, and beef won't be far behind. And then this progressively breaking down supply chain with the shipping situation just going from bad to worse. And in fact, the title of this video, Brace for Impact, those aren't my words. Those come from a shipping expert who's describing that all the supply chain interruptions we've already seen over the last year are nothing compared to what's now going to be caused by all of these continuing interruptions, which are accelerating and heightening. So like I said, each of these independently is something non-trivial, is something significant. But together, we really need to discuss and prepare for what this means. And on a first thought, talk about the shipping situation, where we saw that headline, Brace for Impact. The U.S. import demand is still rising. The container shortage is persisting. Record port volumes have not alleviated this. And while the line of ships that's been waiting to dock off the West Coast and the ports there is now less than 20, there's some progress in emptying the queue there. It's still tremendous the amount of damage that's gone on. And the backlog and the expense for actually securing container storage has only continued to increase. So some of these analysts are saying things like, quote, you ain't seen nothing yet. And I just want to remember to frame these quotes by the reality that there are already shortages of many consumer goods, that we already have a complete shutdown of the semiconductor industry and anything that relies on that, with car factories unable to produce cars because we can't get the chips. And those integrated circuits are in a lot of things. You already know that this whole thing has been set up to falter. This is a generations-long plan in the making of the depopulation agenda, and they've just pulled the rug out now. The data shows that despite this deluge of inbound cargo, the import demand is not abating. In fact, it's increasing. It's getting worse. Importers are trying to catch up. Market capacity is, in most cases, oversold. No realistic improvement is on the horizon. In fact, it looks like it's just going to get worse, leading to more significant disruptions. Again, when you disrupt the supply chain, everything downstream from it falters. We're talking about farmers who can't get parts for their tractors, which further fuels the breakdown of the food supply. We're talking about, we've already seen warnings of gas shortages getting, some people already are finding pumps empty, and that's expected to get worse through the summer when they said about 30% of the gas supply won't be available. In other words, only 2/3 of it will be, and that makes problems with the trucking. So again, it's a series of cascading failures, and it may seem like this is a slow motion collapse, but in terms of economic cycles and really like societal changes, this is happening at light speed. All of this has really kicked off since beginning of 2020, right, with the pandemic. So it's actually, this is a collapse happening in light speed in social terms. Here's another piece from American Shipper. Brace for a shipping tsunami. U.S. importers are going to face even more extreme delays ahead as our container capacity is maxed out. Again, we just can't even get these containers upon which the entire globalized economy depends for shipping parts and goods and pieces of frozen food back and forth, because that's the way the system has been built. Everything depends on this free flowing goods back and forth, and it's not flowing freely right now. So the whole thing is collapsing. The number of container ships stuck at anchor off LA and Long Beach is now down to 20 from 30 a few months ago. Does this mean the capacity crunch is finally easing? No, absolutely not, warned the VP of Global Ocean Freight Forwarder Flexport. It's not getting better, it's getting worse. What I'm seeing is unprecedented. It's a tsunami of freight. During May, everything is basically sold out. We had one client who needed something loaded in May. It was very urgent. He was willing to pay $15,000 for a container. And even then, I couldn't get it. We couldn't even get this done with someone willing to pay whatever it takes. You can't buy it. It's like the food. It's not even a matter of price anymore. It's just not there. We're hitting the wall. We're bottoming out. Now, there is a deluge of more data indicating how rapidly the supply chain is collapsing downwind of this supply chain, of this shipping situation. But I now want to talk about inflation. The Bloomberg Commodity Spot Index has been rocketing up and continues to go nearly vertical throughout April. This is a reflection of almost, you know, a basket of commodities rising up in prices. So when we're talking about commodities, clearly that's steel, which has been exploding in price, lumber, which is one that you probably have noticed as well if you've tried to build anything lately. You really start to get the picture here. If we're not able to import things, then we'll need to build them. If we're not able to grow food, we'll need to build gardens and structures for our animals. But if we can't get wood or steel, if we can't afford it or we can't get it, period, then we won't be able to stand up systems to be able to feed our communities. And that's why, again, the bottom line tonight is that we need to be building our systems that allow us to produce these goods now while there's still something available. Even food prices, of course, food prices are also rising. And that's the one thing I've been hearing the most from people. It's the most visible thing because you viscerally feel that pain when you go try and feed your family at the supermarket, and you can barely walk out without something meaningful without paying a couple hundred dollars at this point. It's for this reason, because people are becoming aware of it, that even the White House put out that message a few weeks ago saying, pay no attention to that inflation behind the curtain. This is a transitory thing. It's just a baseline effects because we had a shutdown last year. So naturally, it's going to look like prices. No, it's not any of these things. The media, of course, ran with those excuses and printed, this is not a big deal. It's going to look like there's some inflation, but it's not real. Nothing to see here, folks. Don't worry about it. The White House did actually mention in that memo that supply chain disruptions are playing into these inflation things. But they make the case that this was all because of the pandemic and it's going back to normal already. And so this is, again, it's transitory. This inflation you're seeing, not a big deal. Don't sweat it. But we just heard from the experts in the shipping industry, it's not getting better. It's getting worse. So this argument too is fallacious. And certainly the White House memo did not speak to the fact that we have printed more dollars than you can even shake a stick at just in the past year. That is literally a vertical line in 2020. And you hear Biden saying we need even more stimulus because of that bad jobs report. So they are by design. It's a controlled demolition of all the systems that feed and clothe and house most people. It's being done. They're grinding us into the dirt, and we need to get off of their systems. So that's not being talked about at all. Now, I don't want to get too far into inflation because actually more and more people are talking about that. That's a good thing. If you are wanting to see some of the parallels behind what's going on now to Weimar, which I've previously said, this is a very Weimar-like hyperinflationary scenario. I recommend you check out this video by George Gammon. Michael Burry warns of hyperinflation, where he puts side by side the charts and the data about how the Weimar Republic printed a ton of money and it gave them basically a sugar high. Things felt good for a little while there. So long as the government could spend money it didn't have faster than the volume could fall, Germany had the war and life as usual. But then ultimately, it's not sustainable. It's a helpful video to compare the history, just like I've done with solar cycles, like what happened during the Maunder minimum. So what can we expect to happen now? Yeah, it's the same sort of a thing. What happened when they printed more money than ever before? How did that play out for them? Well, we know it turned into the wheelbarrow is full of dollars. Here, it's going to be different. It'll be your digital dollars, and this digital currency won't be something you can spend anywhere. It will be used to guide your behavior. You can only spend that money on plant-based foods, not on meat. You can only spend that money on, right? You get the idea. These are additional controls that are being implemented through it's not even a currency at this point. It's money at the slave store, the company store. Now I want to talk about the food situation. Although I've been talking about it a lot, it's just important to mix this into the equation of these other factors as well now. Because when I said in October of 2019 that the USDA was lying, I interviewed a top 1% producer who said they were lying, they were understating the losses and overstating the yields, and that at some point, and he said, there is a force that is trying to give the impression at the USDA that everything was all right. Trying a force and energy working to keep people unaware of the severity of the situation, but that we were running below pipeline levels. In other words, we're burning through our food supply right now, and at some point there will be a day of reckoning. Without that information, farmers are unable to adjust their plantings. The market cannot act to ration supply. We've talked about this a lot. What happens when the U.S. and the world, indeed, runs out of grain? Was the question I asked back in October 2019. Well, now, sadly, I wish it weren't true, but now we do have the answer. Prices are going vertical. Food prices are exploding. The Bloomberg AgriSpot Index has increased 87% just in the last couple months here, and food prices will then do the same. All of these things take time to percolate down. And in fact, for the past year, a lot of this has been absorbed by companies throughout the supply chain who were reticent to raise their prices. But now that everyone's talking about inflation, now that it's called inflation expectation, now that that has increased as well, then it really starts to become a snowball effect. It's a cascading thing where you say, well, gosh, I need to raise my prices so I can still make money here, so I can still conduct business profitably. But if I raise it 10%, that's only going to last me like a week since things are all, everybody else is raising their prices. So I might as well raise my prices 20% just to buy me a little bit of time before I piss off my customers even more. And so that action actually increases the velocity as well. So you can see it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy of this relationship between inflation expectations and actual inflation. And that's what's happening right now as all the price increases are finally rolling out. Retailers, producers, everywhere along the way are finally raising their prices. That's happening now, even as we begin to appreciate everything that I was talking about in September of 2019 when I said, we're about to run out of grains here. What's going to happen? Well, now the big banks are starting to say, we're running out of food. Deutsche Bank said that, was saying that this is going to cause social unrest. This is from Zero Hedge. Deutsche Bank, Jim Reed noted this Bloomberg Agricultural Spot Index had increased 70% year over year, and said that's more than it's ever gone up in a decade here. It's going to create remarkable geopolitical risk for riots and for wars. And that's what happens when food prices explode. People can't afford to eat. They take to the streets. Of course, Deutsche Bank was only repeating the warning that was issued by Rabobank here in March when they said when they released their biblical lean and mean report, talking about how they couched this whole thing in the story of Joseph, where there were 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine. And they were saying, yeah, we're going into the famine now. This whole report talks about Pharaoh and Joseph's dream and Technicolor dream coat language. So there's tongue in cheek because they're sitting there in their bank ivory tower where they're going to be able to eat no matter what. But what they're describing is that, yeah, food prices are exploding, and particularly for third world countries and countries that depend on imports from the breadbasket countries, they're in a world of hurt right now. We see every day more and more steps. Russia, just a couple days ago, put a new limit on the amount of wheat that they're willing to export. And as Ukraine, Russia, Brazil, Argentina also just increased the duties because Brazil is so hungry, they were starting to come for their grains, and Argentina said, whoa, no. So as these breadbasket countries, these major exporters, shut down that flow of food out to keep their own domestic population fed and prices under control, the importers are, we heard actually that one of the agricultural minister of Turkmenistan said, if you put a cap on how much you're willing to export to us, you are dooming us to starvation. This is not a word you hear frequently between diplomats, right? This tells you that that it's a meaningful impact when the breadbasket countries stop their exports. In fact, it's exactly what was described by George Soros funded, John Podesta run food chain reaction game back in 2015, where they foresaw a pandemic disrupting the supply chains and causing a global food crisis. Of course, the outcome that came out of that whole exercise, which was also run by Cargill, one of the world's biggest food companies, was a global carbon tax. You can see where this whole thing is running. That's why I call it an engineered food shortage. So again, the reports I just mentioned from the banks talking about how we're now going into 7 years of famine and the third world is going to be hurting and we're in intense geopolitical risk, all of that is based on now. And now flows from the crop losses and the fact that we were running at below pipeline levels for the last 2 years, since 2019, as I covered. I'm not making this up. And now what's happening is that it's the same thing. Just as we talked about the shipping, it's getting worse. You haven't even seen anything yet. The same thing is true with food production. Brazil had a terrible season with their soybeans, tremendous precipitative extremes like that we would expect during a grand solar minimum that delayed the harvest of soybeans and meant that the safrinha crop, as they call it, was very delayed. So delayed, in fact, that each week as they come out with their new crop progress numbers, it's just gone down straight downhill from bad to worse. And Arlen Suderman here is saying, with their safrinha crop failing as badly as it is, we're going to need to significantly have more corn coming out of the United States. That's the bottom line. We need more corn. He just says it's required. He doesn't say what happens if we don't get it. We need more acres or above trend yields. We need a ton of corn coming out of the U.S. this year and soybeans. It's required. Of course, Arlen is not going to say, or else the whole thing is going to come crashing down, right? Or else global trade and food prices are going to explode through the roof. The problem, ladies and gentlemen, is that it's not shaping up to be a good season for the United States. We've got a tremendous drought going on. You can see reported here yesterday, 9 of the 10 top U.S. corn states reported abnormal dryness or severe drought on 42% or more of acreage this week. These precipitative extremes are happening as well here. And in fact, we're currently in a cold spell in a lot of the Corn Belt, which is, it's not frosting, it's not frozen, but it's cold enough that it is affecting germination. And I've heard from a lot of producers who are saying it's not looking good. Sometimes, especially the bigger producers who are under contract, are required by those big ag companies, Monsanto, you know the players, Syngenta, they are required to, by contract, to plant their crops when they're told to. And those orders went out, and so those seeds are in the ground. But now it's very cold, and now they're planting into the dust. And so they know, they already know, and they're telling me, yields aren't going to be here this year. So even as we hear Arlen saying, we require a really good crop out of the U.S. for the whole global food situation to stay operational, I'm hearing it's not going to happen. So I'm saying, just like the shipping guy said, we're not even fully seeing the effects. We are not even in the food crisis yet. And already we're at record decadal highs for corn and soybeans. We ain't seen nothing yet. It's not just the global grains crisis. All of these things have been mounting. Today, reported in the mainstream media. In the mainstream media, we're hearing about meat shortages again. Restaurants facing a nationwide chicken shortage. Family-owned restaurants around the U.S. are struggling to keep a steady supply of chicken tenders, wings, and breasts on their plates due to a nationwide poultry shortage. Oops, that was supposed to be before. It's about how large the drought, how bad the drought conditions are across many parts of the U.S. And this is about how bad the drought is in South America. It's so bad, not only has it affected the safrinha crop, but the levels of the rivers have gone down, and they can't even float barges there to export their grains. So their yields were reduced, and even that they did grow, they can't get out because, here, quote, barges are carrying less than their usual load. The situation is so desperate in Paraguay, the country is begging Brazil to please release some water so we can export our grains and feed the rest of the world. So it's just staggering. But back to the proteins. We have a chicken shortage. We're also expecting to see beef run into shortages as well. Here's a message from National Farmers who are saying, you can expect to see short supplies of beef at the counter. Our exports are collapsing, down 28% week over week and down 18% versus the average because it's not there, because we're running out of beef to export at this point. Right? We've already taken a look in the past at how our frozen protein shortages, frozen beef, frozen chicken, have all dropped precipitously over the last year throughout the pandemic. So we've already eaten through that buffer. We no longer have that reserve to draw upon from our frozen meat stocks. So given this global grains shortage, given the protein shortages, of course, the establishment is starting to really ratchet up their rhetoric around, well, we might need to go ahead and have GMOs. Now, you're just going to have to do it. You're going to have to accept GMO now that we've got global warming. That's the carte blanche for everything, because Club of Rome says it's a climate emergency. So Bloomberg, the cure for our food shortages, and this is the seismic change that's happening right now, is that the media, and this is how you know we're at that demarcation point, we're going to start feeling the food shortages now, because they've started putting in place the scripting to suggest to you the solutions. This is the problem, reaction, solution, Hegelian dialectic that I know you know this by heart by now. You've heard it so many times. They've played it so many times, tried and tested. But when you see Bloomberg saying, now that we got these food shortages, you're going to have to eat GMO. It was the same argument that we heard from the CEO of the bio barcode company, Anika, that I mentioned in my previous report. He said, well, consumers are just going to have to change their behavior because climate change. You're not going to be able to eat unless you eat GMO. So this is their excuse. This is their wedge to force a change in diet. It's exactly what the Eat Lancet Commission told us they were going to do, is force a complete fundamental transformation of our food supply because of climate change. And indeed, it's happening. All of their stated goals, get off animal agriculture, end meat and dairy. We're seeing the scripting being laid here right now from Food Processing Magazine. Cultured meat is growing in popularity. Doesn't matter if you call it lab grown or cultured or cell based, they're becoming more popular. Yeah, sure they are. We're running out of meat is what's happening. And that's why companies like Nestle, the biggest food company in the world, is now rolling out their new plant-based milk. Nestle is jumping into the alternative milks arena, coming out with a product made from yellow peas to be sold in Europe. The product was created in just 6 months. That's much longer than it took for the vaccine, at least. But they are rushing to market with plant-based and lab-grown meat and dairy, because they know we're there. We're at that demarcation point. But it's not just the synthetic, lab-grown, engineered, and even plant-based, sort of a stepping stone on the way there, of food that's being rolled out. There's another narrative, and this one is even more telling. This is something from SCMP. China food security. This food crisis, it's actually more of a livestock feed challenge. China is not producing enough feed grains like soybeans to support the livestock industry. And that's why it's relying on imports and sucking out the substance of Brazil and the US for that matter, and from everywhere in the world that they're able to import. The deficit is, here we go, driving concern about food security, and it's really complicated. Oh, now we see that the reason we're running out of food is because of animals, right? Now we see the real excuse to end animal agriculture. We've heard Bill Gates talk about why we should all be eating lab-grown meat. We've heard the mission statement from Impossible Foods, which he funds, which is end animal agriculture. But it's just not working. People, even save the earth from climate change, people just don't care. We've seen the latest statistics, even for Gen Z, it says 70% of them don't want to eat lab-grown meat. So it's not going to work unless they engineer food shortages and blame the animals. And they're doing it now. This is a new narrative that we've not seen yet. Turns out, according to the mainstream media, we are competing with our animals for food. And if we have food shortages, it's their fault, and we're going to have to do away with animal agriculture. We just can't do it. We don't have enough food to feed them. They're dirty and dangerous and pandemic-ridden anyway. But now they're competing with you for us to be able to feed you. So we're going to have to do away with it. And this is not unique to China. Here's Bloomberg. Just a couple days ago, feeding chickens is so costly that it's changing global trade flows. Some feed makers in the US and China are now changing to wheat. We've talked about how they're reformulating their animal feed, trying to move away from corn and soybeans and using wheat. But wheat prices are on the rise. That's why Russia just stopped their exports. And feeding the world's chickens, pigs, and cows has gotten so expensive, it's upending global trade flows. Please pay attention to the narrative that's being constructed in real time right now before our eyes. It's because of livestock. It's because of animal agriculture that we're having a food crisis. And even this even intimates that the whole supply chain might be affected because we're too busy trying to feed China's animals. This is a stunning shifting of the blame to try and pin animals as the reason that everything is hitting the fan right now. As grain prices surge, American chicken giant Purdue has taken the rare steps of buying soybeans from Brazil. This has also happened just a week ago. U.S. is now importing soybeans from Brazil. We're one of the biggest producers in the world. Why are we exporting all of our soybeans to China, but then being forced to buy them from Brazil? Yeah, we're not making sense here. There's no good leadership here. But these tactics highlight how tight the global market has become. Grain prices at an eight-year high, the cost of feeding animals, and higher meat prices will be coming for animals. They are creating this argument that now there's a food crisis and it's because of the animals. It's because we can't feed them and you. And so we'll have to grow the meat in a lab and end animal agriculture, and then we'll have enough grains again. It's always the promise. Everything will go back to normal if we get rid of animal agriculture. So they're going to make people feel the pain. They're going to have food prices rise, food shortages, meat shortages. Meat shortages are already happening, and they're blaming animal agriculture and promising that, well, things will go back to normal if you just eat Bill Gates' meat, if you just eat the lab meat. Aren't you impressed by the celebrity steaks? Don't you want to try the cell-cultured, human-cultured cheek meat where you can take a scraping off your cheek and then put it in a vat of cell-cultured? It's amazing. But all of these things, these disgusting things that defile God's creation, now they're saying, we have to move to that. We can't do things the way we have been anymore. Traditional farming and ranching is done because of the crisis. Look at this. It's a crisis. We're running out of grains, and it's because of animals. So this is a really critical concept, and I hope I've done justice to it. Perhaps I should have said this at the beginning of the video. And it's working. It's working. We've already seen that the size of herds, not just in the U.S., around the world, is decreasing. Here in the U.S., more downsizing for the beef herd is likely in 2021. Beef feedlot placements are way down. They're just not calving as much as they were in the past, just like the shipping and just for the grains. There will be even fewer cows next year because the herd is downsizing here in the U.S. The same is true here in the U.K. from farmersweekly.uk. Cow numbers are incredibly tight with DEFRA, their UK version of the FDA, the same people that admitted they were walking around gassing people's chickens. I'm still mad about that. DEFRA is showing that the national herd is now at its lowest since 1910. Think about that. The UK has less cows than they have in over 100 years. They're ending animal agriculture. From Bloomberg, again, sorry steak lovers, Australia is running out of cows. Russia also now seeing the strongest poultry production decline in a decade. Just in the first 2 months of 21, Russian poultry production dropped 6.2% year over year. 6% drop in chicken production and eggs. So we can see that it's working, that the meat industry is being forcibly shut down, and that moreover, now we're at that point, that line of demarcation, like I said, where they're telling you there's a food crisis, and worse yet, they're blaming animal agriculture and preparing to shut it down completely because we had to, or we couldn't be able to feed you and the animals. So where are we? Because I think we've painted a pretty complete picture, even though there's so much more we could talk about on any of these three topics, and certainly on the race war that's being engineered, ginned up by the media and by the government. And of course, we could even get into the fact that we're now looking at massive number of people injected with experimental injections. And, who knows how that will actually start to manifest over the next year. But even just taking into consideration, because it's enough, the three things I've talked about tonight, the shipping, right? The shipping crisis and the supply chain breaking down, which is a cascading situation, the inflation, which is another cascading and accelerating situation, and the food shortages. All of these are conspiring to create a situation where, you know, if it was just one of them, you could maybe be creative and figure out a way to feed your family and stand up new ways to grow food and raise animals and be there for your community, or switch to a more local economy. But together, if there's no supplies and there's no food and there's no currency, it's a really dangerous situation. And my advice to you, as I've been saying for weeks now, remains, you cannot remain a consumer. You cannot be a consumer in that environment, because there's nothing to consume and there's no money to buy it with. You have to be a producer. And just as for years I have been saying, you must grow your own food, we're heading into engineered food shortages. And the answer to that, the answer to a failure of a centralized food system, is for you to grow your own food, is a decentralized food system where we all grow.
in his report here, was talking about how some certain areas, people aren't seeing this, other areas they are. That's why I've been gone for the past 2 weeks. I've been checking out a whole bunch of different areas and doing a lot of driving, and I'm seeing it in some places. There are certain, New Mexico, to give you an idea, the whole state is destroyed. It's almost as if the depression is hit. 75% of all small businesses are gone. I mean, gone. They either just closed the doors and left, or they filed bankruptcy and they're toast. So this is happening all over. Some places you're not seeing it. Some places they are. Dimwit did something good by accident, I'm sure, because of the problem that we're having in the supply chain. And they made some insane rules for truckers. They can only drive certain amount of hours in a 24-hour period. And there's a lot of information on the trucking firms that if you people have actually listened to me over the years, everything that I'm going to be telling you this show, you already have the leading edge of knowledge. So it won't be a surprise to you about what's happening. It's allowed now for truckers to drive, and I'm not sure. I haven't been able to find the exact regulation now, but it used to be you can only drive 8 hours in a certain period of time, and now it's more. You should see how many trucks are on a road now. The police are kind of looking the other way as they're speeding. If the speed limit's 70 miles an hour, the trucks are doing 75 to 80, and unless they're weaving, the cops are just letting them go because they're trying to get stuff delivered. Everywhere. You name a product and there's a shortage of it. I don't care what it is. And the cost of food? Let's say something sells for $1 a pound. Well, now all of a sudden, let's say it's $1.10 a pound. Well, that's 10% increase. 10%. Most people don't even see that. They don't even understand that. But when you spend $200 a week on food and now you go in and it's $250 a week, you're going to see it and you're going to see shortages of stuff. And I just got some information that almost nobody knows. UPS, you know, United Parcel Service, they have the normal UPS trucks, then they have UPS delivery trucks, shipping, which is like the 40-foot shipping trucks or the 18-wheelers or the 53-footers. They were bought by a company owned by Chinese. This company is called T-Force, and this guy gave me this information not wanting me to give out his name because he'd lose his job. He's not sure what's going on, but he's got a bad feeling that this company is going to basically sell everything off to Amazon. I'm sure we'll find out, but so far, anything the Chinese have bought has ended up screwing Americans. The longer that dimwit's in charge of the Shady Acres in Washington, D.C., the more I see his communist handler's fingerprints. He is now going to be bringing in a Muslim, to investigate the U.S. military because there's extremists in the U.S. military. And who's better to pick them out other than somebody who isn't a white guy? I'm just totally astounded. But then again, dimwit's ATF nominee. You're going to love this. You know, he has all these different people that he wants in charge of all kinds of things. And it's a sad thing that it has to actually go through the Senate to be verified. So during the confirmation hearing, he was asked certain questions by congressmen and by senators. And obviously, the Democrats could care less about anything. But this is a little blurb that came up, and it reminded me of an incident that occurred with me. And I'll explain that when we're done.
Is a law-abiding gun owner a threat to public safety, in your view?
Thank you for that question, Senator. If the term law-abiding means someone has lawfully possessed a gun, there are often occasions that person then goes on to commit a violent crime.
Some years ago, I was approached by Assemblywoman Jackie Speer in California, and because I'm an expert in pepper spray and stun guns, non-lethal self-defense, in other words. And she wanted me to help her draft a bill legalizing pepper spray for people in California. She's got a big push on women's rights, women's defending themselves against rapists and muggers and things like that. But she hates guns, so she wanted something that was non-lethal that they could use. So I helped her draft a bill. And it eventually passed. But what I had to do was I had to debate the Assistant Attorney General of the state of California on a Senate floor, the Subcommittee Safeties floor. And during this debate, the Assistant Attorney General of the state of California turned to me and said, look, here, the bottom line is this. We don't want any more weapons in the hands of criminals. And I said, sir, criminals are actually excluded from being able to buy and use pepper spray. And he said, no, you don't understand. We consider, now he's speaking from an elitist communistic viewpoint, because that's what they are. They're Democrats and they're communists. He said, we consider all citizens criminals. We just haven't caught them yet. Luckily, my response was headed off by the only Republican on the committee who said, let's take a break now. Let's go have some coffee. Anyway, the bill passed. But what I discovered at that point was that these elitists, these Democrats, their viewpoint is that all citizens are criminals. And that's why we need them to protect everyone from ourselves. So this is what he wants to have in the ATF. He's anti-gunner. He is anti-American. And he's just another typical communist. Another point, Department of Homeland Security. All right, so they're in charge of all our security, right? All the safety in Homeland. And you have all these Mexicans and Guatemalans and San Salvadorans and all of these people from all over the world that come to the United States and they want to get green cards so they can work here. So they have to fill out this form, and this form has a bunch of different questions on it, lots of different questions, because it's our right to know what kind of person is going to come into our country and actually work here. On this form, there's actually a question that says, are you affiliated or do you know anyone that's affiliated with any gangs, whether domestic or foreign? Well, the Department of Homeland Security has decided that's too aggressive. So they're going to do away with that question. And we're going to talk a little bit about something else. Senator Joseph McCarthy, 1950, he decided that it's about time people started to become aware that the United States is being taken over by communists. He knew that communists had been taking over the media of all kinds, newspaper, theater, movies. He knew that communists had infiltrated themselves into nuclear power plants, electrical generation plants, into the pharmaceutical community, and even into the army, and into the Senate and the Congress. These were known communists. And as they gained power, they basically made everyone look the other direction so that their work was not discovered. Well, McCarthy came out. He's just saying he was a senator, and he came out and said, no, we need to find these communists. So there were hearings that occurred. And the sad thing is, the only senators that were against McCarthy were communist Democrats. Here is a little blurb of one of the hearings.
Mr. Cohn, what is the exact number of communists or subversives that are loose today in these defense plants?
I can only tell you, sir, what we know about.
Well, that's 130, is that right?
Yes, sir. I'm going to try to particularize for you if I can.
How many plants are they?
I see 16 offhand.
16 plants. Are you alarmed at that situation, Mr. Cole?
Yes, sir, I am.
Nothing could be more alarming, could it? Will you not, before the sun goes down, give those names to the FBI and at least have those men put under surveillance?
When the need arises, of course.
Then they've got the whole 130, have they, Mr. Cole?
I am sure of it, sir, and a lot.
Well, then what's all the excitement about if J. Edgar Hoover is on the job chasing these 130 communists? Well, then as a second line of defense, let's send the 130 names to the Department of Defense tonight. Would you mind doing that?
Whatever the committee directs on that, sir.
I wish the committee would direct that all the names be sent both to the FBI and to the Department of Defense with extreme suddenness.
Mr. Chairman, I so move.
But in view of Mr. Welch's request that the information be given once we know of anyone who might be performing any work for the Communist Party, I think we should tell him that he has in his law firm a young man named Fisher whom he recommended, incidentally, to do the work on this committee, who has been for a number of years a member of an organization which was named, oh, years and years ago, as the legal bulwark of the Communist Party, an organization which always springs to the defense of anyone who dares to expose communists. I certainly assume that Mr. Welch did not know of this young man at the time he recommended him as the assistant counsel for this committee, but he has such terror and such a great desire to know where anyone is located who may be serving the communist cause, Mr. Welch, that I thought we should just call to your attention the fact that your Mr. Fisher, who is still in your law firm today, whom you asked to have down here looking over the secret and classified material, is a member of an organization not named by me, named by various committees, named by the Attorney General, as I recall. He belonged to it long after it had been exposed as the legal arm of the Communist Party. Knowing that, Mr. Welch, I just felt that I had a duty to respond to your urgent request that before sundown, when we know of anyone serving the communist cause, we let the agency know. We are now letting you know that your man did belong to this organization for either 3 or 4 years, belonged to it long after he was out of law school. Now, I have hesitated bringing that up, but I have been rather bored with your phony request to Mr. Cohen here that he personally get every communist out of government before sundown. Therefore, we will give you the information about the young man in your own organization. I'm not asking you at this time to explain why you tried to foist him on this committee, whether you knew that he was a member of that communist organization or not. I don't know. I assume you did not, Mr. Welch, because I get the impression that while you are quite an actor, you play for a laugh, I don't think you have any conception of the danger of the Communist Party. I don't think you yourself would ever knowingly aid the Communist cause. I think you are unknowingly aiding it when you try to burlesque this hearing in which we are attempting to bring out the fact.
Now, the organization that was communistic that the lawyer for that senator had worked for was the ACLU. Came to be known as the American Civil Liberties Union. And that's what communists do, is they use brave words and patriotic sounds to hide the actual reality of what they are. Now, you have Democrat, Socialist, Communist. Socialism is only a stop-off point to the destruction, the full destruction of capitalism in the American way. So you find all these socialist people out here that they're only socialists until they finish their destruction, and then they become full communists. About 10 years ago, I did a show. I put all my shows on YouTube. I've got hundreds of my shows on YouTube. And by the way, anybody who listens to my shows on YouTube, stop doing so, because they're going to be pulling me off of that. They already threatened me twice. They've already canceled out 3 or 4 of my shows. Before they gained full control over it and started canceling everyone, they took one of my shows off. Only one of my shows that I had put up in the past 20 years on YouTube, or however long they've been up there, have they ever taken off. And I'm going to play that show for you. You're going to see why they took it off. And then when you get done listening to that show, I'll explain to you why I was gone for 2 weeks.
Okay, now we're going to have to get into what my show is going to be about, and it's going to be about Jews. When I was a kid, we had a guy down the street. He worked for NASA. He made things. He made the first hover car. It was a coffee can on top of a square cake pan. I'm not kidding you. And it was remote controlled. And he used it to chase dogs down the street. Little gas motor on it. He made all kinds of interesting things. He did weird stuff. I mean, other than that, he studied the Talmud. The Talmud is the Jewish Bible. Don't let him lie to you and tell you it's the first few books of the normal Bible. It's not. The Talmud is. He studied it not because he was a Jew, but because he wanted to learn Hebrew, and that's what it's written in. It's got over 6,000 pages to it. He made a list of different things that it said, and he wanted he wanted me to read it. He wouldn't show it to any other kids. He showed it to me, and he showed it to some guys down the street. We're called Goyim. That's Yiddish for cattle, or Hebrew for cattle. Because if you're not Jewish, you're an animal. And according to the Talmud, they can rape you, steal from you, have sex with you, have sex with children as young as 3 years old. And we own nothing because everything on earth is owned by Jews when they want it. We hold it for them, and they take it when they're ready for it. Because if you're not Jewish, you have no soul. You're an animal. You're a creature below dogs. So he's very nonchalant about this, and he's showing me this stuff. And there was more. There was so much stuff in there. I didn't understand a lot of it. I mean, I was like 10 years old, 11 years old. But my mother was very religious, so we studied a lot of religious writings. In fact, at the time, I was reading the lost books of the Bible. By the time I was 10 years old, I'd read the Bible twice. So I'd like to read the Talmud someday. And he said, well, unless you learn Hebrew, you won't find it because it's been translated into different languages, but they leave out all kinds of stuff when they translate it because they don't want anyone but Jews to know the truth. So, okay. I never thought about anything like that. I thought it was just kind of a joke until years later. I knew some Jews in high school, and thinking back, I realized these were the most perverted, screwed up people I've ever met in my life. I can't even tell you over the air what my best friend Ken did. I mean, he would do psychotic things all the time, and he was a Jew and went to temple and the whole nine yards, and he always had the best dope anybody had. I didn't smoke it. He wouldn't give it to me anymore. I would smoke a few joints, and all I do is stand around going, you guys done with this crap? I'm hungry. Let's go get something to eat. While they're laying on the ground going, wow, look at the shadows. And then there were females that were Jews in my school, and they were, let's just say, messed up. No, I mean, they were the head of the messed up group. So it's not like there was other people trying to catch up with them. There was nothing near them. See, and we were treated, all of us were treated as if we were secondary to them. I never thought about it. At the time, I never thought, there's a lot of things that happen through your life that you never really think about. You just wonder about. You say, oh, this happened here, this happened here, and this happened here. And then a decade down the chain a little bit, you look back and you go, oh, that's why they acted like that. Now I understand. Ken used to tell me, he goes, you know, you Christians, you're so limited. I go, what are you talking about? He goes, you only got 10 commandments. We got 613. I go, BS. That's not true. He goes, no, it's right here. And he had his dad had a copy of the Talmud. And he said, yep, it's in there, 613. I go, how do you know? He goes, my dad told me. Well, do you believe him? Jews don't lie to Jews. He said that to me. So to this day, I don't know if he ever learned Hebrew, so if he could read it or not, I don't know. Play this. This is the Zionist story. Zion is a belief of where somebody wants their own country and nobody else whatsoever. That's a Zionist. That's somebody who wants, like a black Zionist, want only blacks in the country, nobody else. A white Zionist, nobody else but whites. And this was a Jewish Zionist. Now, this whole story is, you don't have the before. The whole concept of Israel and the Zionists started with communists. Maybe most of you don't know this, but communism was created by the Jews. The majority of Jews worldwide are communists. All of early Russia, the Bolshevik Revolution, was all communists, which were Jews. All of them. There was five communist Jews that showed up in Palestine to start this whole mess. And that's not talked about on this little cut. This is a 24-minute cut. Go ahead and play clip one, Todd.
In Switzerland, have possibly something to do with how it all went wrong. Basel was the setting for the first Zionist convention in 1897. Zionism was a national Jewish revival movement that sought to unite all Jews in a national homeland. They just weren't sure where that homeland was. Up until 1897, there were all kinds of crazy ideas thrown into the air, like Uganda, Alaska, Madagascar, and other less exotic destinations. In Basel, however, the Zionist movement decided on an ideal and historically relevant location, Palestine. But what if the people who were already living in Palestine didn't want to have a national Jewish home set up in their country. The Zionists had some clear ideas about that problem from the very beginning. Theodor Herzl, considered to be the founder of Zionism, wrote in 1895, "We shall try to spirit away the penniless population across the border." Leo Motzkin, one of Zionism's most liberal thinkers, wrote, "The colonization of Palestine has to go in two directions, Jewish settlements in Eretz Israel and the resettlement of Arabs in areas outside the country." Chaim Weizmann, the head of the World Zionist Congress and future president of Israel, proclaimed the Palestinians to be the rocks of Judea, obstacles that need to be cleared on a difficult path.
The Jewish people came into this country, said this is our country, and they didn't say it's our country, but we recognize that there's another people living here. Let's see what we can work out. No, the whole idea of Israel until today is this is our country from the Mediterranean to the Jordan River, and it's only our country. It's exclusively our country. There is no other people. There's a bunch of Arabs living here, that we know. There's no other people with a claim to the country, with a legitimate right to the country. This is our country exclusively, and therefore, either you shut up if you're a Palestinian and you live in one of the little islands we'll give you by sufferance, not by right, or get out.
But back to the story. At the end of the 19th century, there were hardly any Jews living in Palestine. So the Zionists started campaigning all over the world for Jews to immigrate to Palestine. Most Jews thought the idea sounded like a pitch for a horror movie and decided to immigrate to the US instead. But some Jews naturally came to Palestine. The Zionists also launched Operation Buy a State. They went and bought all the land they could from Palestinian absentee landlords. Once the land was theirs, they threw out all the Palestinians that were living on it. The Zionists called this process Judifying the Land and Land Redemption. Then, in 1917, the British conquered Palestine from the Turks. They legalized the Jewish national home idea with the Balfour Declaration in the same year.
Palestine became a special case because the British violated the provisions of the Mandate for Palestine, because they put the Balfour Declaration into the Palestine Mandate. What did this mean? It meant that for Palestine, the wishes of the inhabitants, 90% Arab, would not be listened to, and they would not be developed for independence. It would be Jews, once they came in through immigration, they would be allowed to develop. And so it's really with the Palestinian Mandate and the violation of the mandatory provisions to give the Zionists the right to create a majority of Jews to create a Palestinian state, that the real Palestinian is Zionist conflict begins.
The Palestinians launched two popular uprisings against the Jews and the British blatant pro-Zionist policies. The first took place in 1929 and claimed hundreds of Palestinians and Jewish lives. The second, in 1936, was practically a small-scale war between the Palestinians and the British, who were also aided by the Zionists. It lasted for 3 years, and in the end, approximately 5,000 Palestinians died. The British also exiled the Palestinians' leadership and dismantled all Palestinians' paramilitary units. The Palestinians were left defenseless and leaderless.
Most of the Israeli commanders had studied the British reaction to the Palestinian revolt in 1936 and 1939, which became the manual book of what to do to the Palestinians in case of resistance. In fact, most of the atrocities you read about, and I'm sure most of you in this place know about it, most of the atrocities that you enlist as severe violations of human rights and civil rights in Palestine today, most of these violations were invented not by a Jewish Zionist mind, but by British mandatory authorities in the war against the Palestinians between 1936 to 1939. Examples: the idea that you demolish houses of people is a British invention. The idea that in order to make a search memorable to people, you destroy a house and then you move to the other house and then to the other house and then to the other house was an invention by British officers on the ground. The idea that you shoot people without warning them or you arrest them without trial, it's all from the reservoir of the mandatory anti-Arab measures in 1936 to 1939. But of course the Israelis added their own brutal and callous ideas as the occupation continued.
Then, in the 1940s, the cards turned. Following a string of British pro-Palestinian policies, the Zionists launched terrorist attacks on British personnel and facilities.
Violence continues to rule in Palestine. British soldiers seek bodies in the Department of Labor building at Chechnik, where a few minutes before, a blast had partially wrecked the edifice. Three policemen were blown to bits when they tried to remove an explosive-laden truck. Shaky walls are torn down.
After a bomb explosion caused by terrorists on the British headquarters at Jerusalem, one entire corner of the King David Hotel, a building of seven stories, was razed to the ground. The stone floors were cut.
88 innocent people died, and a good deal of the British high command was wiped out. Their goal was to drive the British out of Palestine. The mastermind of the King David bombing was Menachem Begin. He would become Israel Prime Minister. His accomplice, Yitzhak Shamir, would also later become Prime Minister. The pattern of terrorists, or, in other words, brutal military leaders transforming into top politicians, is very common in Israeli politics. At this point, the British have had enough, and they transferred the matter of Palestine to the UN.
The United Nations sent a committee to evaluate this in the summer of 47, and they recommended partition. And the Zionists eagerly accepted this, and the Palestinian Arabs didn't, because they were still two-thirds of the population, and they felt this was unjust. But nonetheless, this partition, which was approved in the UN after Thanksgiving in 1947, officially recognized two states.
In 1947, the Jews owned 5.8% of the land. In the UN partition plan, the Jews ended up with 56% of the land, almost 10 times of what they actually owned. The Palestinians had half of their land stolen right under their noses. Their population was split into two, half of it living in the Zionist state as a minority. Even in the borders of the Jewish state, the Jews owned only 11% of the land.
The resolution of the Dutch Committee for Palestine was adopted by 33 votes, 13 against, 10 abstentions.
Why would the UN be so blatantly pro-Zionist? To not underestimate the power of guilt. Anyone heard of the Holocaust? The UN sought to compensate the Jews over the deaths of 6 million Jews in World War II. However, this amount of land, more than half of Palestine, was still not enough for the Zionists. David Ben-Gurion, the leader of the Zionist movement in Palestine, wrote in 1937, "The Arabs will have to go, but one needs an opportune moment for making it happen, such as a war." The Palestinians had no desire to fight the Zionists or start a war. They were used to living under different sovereigns for hundreds of years. Egyptians, Turks, British, and now the Zionists. In 1948, Ben-Gurion tells the Jewish agency executives, "I believe that the majority of the Palestinian masses accept the partition as fait accompli and do not believe it is possible to overcome or reject it. The decisive majority of them do not want to fight us." Towards the end of 1947, the Zionist leadership came together and drew Plan Dalit. Plan Dalit was about securing the borders of Israel by cleansing, expelling, and destroying Palestinian towns, villages, and urban neighborhoods. The plan was implemented by the Zionist armed forces.
And finally, in March, they began a push to ensure their control of areas that would become Israel under the partition. And as that happened, you began to get many more Palestinian Arabs fleeing, particularly after a massacre at a place called Deir Yassin. Begin and the Irgun and the Stern Gang, Yitzhak Shamir was part of that. There was a combined attack in this Palestinian village that massacred many people. And the Palestinians did carry out a retaliatory raid, killing about 70 Jewish doctors on the road to Jerusalem shortly thereafter. But after that, you had mobile radio bands that Begin put into play, threatening more Deir Yassins if the Arabs didn't flee. In other words, you'll be massacred just like Deir Yassin. So it became part of the propaganda.
Between the 30th of March and 15th of May, 1948, 200 villages were occupied and their inhabitants expelled. In some villages, such as Deir Yassin and Ain al-Zaytun, horrible massacres were perpetrated. The towns of Tiberias, Haifa, Tzfat, Beisan, Jaffa, and Acre fell into Zionist hands. As a result, more than 250,000 Palestinians were expelled. All of this took place before the 1948 war even started, before one regular Arab soldier set his foot on Palestinian soil. It is important to note that during that time, the British had almost 70,000 troops in Palestine. Their mandate, which lasted until the 15th of May, 1948, was to maintain law and order and to protect civilians. They failed miserably in that obligation. While the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians was going on, the Zionists were busy announcing to the world that a second Holocaust was imminent. The Jews were about to be overrun and thrown into the sea. At the same time, in February 1948, Ben-Gurion wrote to his foreign minister, "We will be able not only to defend, but also to take over Palestine as a whole. I am in no doubt of this. We can face all the Arab forces." Confident of their victory, the Zionists declared independence on the 14th of May, 1948, and Ben-Gurion became the first prime minister. On the 15th of May, 1948, seven Arab countries declared war on Israel and invaded Palestine. In a joint public statement, they explained their reasons. The Zionist aggression in Palestine resulted in the exodus of more than a quarter of a million of its Arab inhabitants and in their taking refuge in the neighboring Arab countries. In the beginning of the 1948 war, the Arab forces amounted to approximately 22,000 fighters. The Zionists had 40,000 soldiers. The Jordanians had an army that would have evened the odds. However, King Abdullah decided to sit this one out. Instead, he defended only the bits he wanted to attach to Jordan, Jerusalem, and the West Bank.
And one of the myths of this whole period is that you had a little Israel, small Zionists against the Palestinians, and then later on in the war, when the Arab states invaded, that it was David versus Goliath, they were facing overwhelming odds. But this was simply not true, because even then, Israel, from May of 48 on, had more troops than the Arab states, who had a very small army. But that's one of those things that many people believe. When you had the Arab state invasion, Egypt, Syria, you had Iraqi troops, you had some Saudi, the Lebanese did very little, and you had the Transjordanians. This will become Jordan, which includes the West Bank after 1948. Well, when they invaded, there was no coordination, because no one trusted Abdullah of Transjordan, because he had been dealing with the Zionists in sort of what we might call a non-aggression pact. Although many Israeli historians deny this vociferously, there clearly were discussions and agreements. And although maps show that when you have this attack, you have what we call a Transjordanian attack against Israel, in fact, there was really no attack per se. They were holding on to positions in the West Bank, but where you did have conflict was over Jerusalem. But the Israelis were able, the Zionists, well, they were Israelis after May 14th. When they were confronting the Egyptians, for example, or other people, they really didn't have to worry about their backs in terms of where the Jordanians were, because the Jordanians weren't going to attack them.
While the war was going on, the Zionists increased their ethnic cleansing operations. Villagers were expelled en masse, and massacres occurred in many places. The villages of Hula, Salia, and Basa were but a few to suffer such atrocities during 1948. When Zionist troops occupied the village that resisted them, they would round up all the men according to lists the intelligence officers would provide. On the whim of the local commander, they would either shoot them or march them away. The biggest expulsion and massacre happened in the city of Lid Ramle. 50,000 people were expelled from the city in a single day. 426 men, women, and children were killed by the Zionist forces. General in charge of the occupation and expulsion of Lid Ramle was Yitzhak Rabin, who would later become Israel Prime Minister, serving two terms. In 1948, the Chicago Sunday Times reported on the Israeli tactics. Practically everything in their way died. Riddled corpses lay by the side of the roads. The New York Herald Tribune wrote, "Corpses of Arab men, women, and even children strewn about in the wake of the ruthlessly brilliant charge." The London Economist reported, "The Arab refugees were systematically stripped of all of their belongings. Then they were sent on their trek to the frontier. The Arab armies succeeded in occupying several remote Jewish settlements for a few days. They also successfully attacked army convoys, but the final victory, unsurprisingly, belonged to the Zionists. They conquered 80% of Palestine, destroyed 531 villages, 11 urban neighborhoods, and towns. Approximately 750,000 Palestinians were ethnically cleansed and were forced to leave everything behind as they fled for their lives. However, the ethnic cleansing didn't stop in 1948. It just shifted gear. In 1967, in the Six Day War, Israel conquered what was left of Palestine, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip. Now, the remaining 20% of Palestine and all the Palestinians were under Zionist control. Under the army's protection and with the government's aid, Israeli settlements were erected in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Today, they cut through the Palestinian land and keep spreading. Some of them, like Ariel and Maale Adumim, are already considered to be cities. The purpose of these Jewish enclaves is to isolate and stifle Palestinian settlements. This is achieved also through roads for Jews only, military checkpoints, and land seizure. The Palestinians rose up against the Israeli oppression in two popular uprisings, or intifadas, first started in 1987 and ended in 1993. The Palestinians stood up to the Israeli oppression, extrajudicial killings, mass detentions, house demolitions, deportations, and land seizure. They were no match for the well-equipped Israeli army. Over 1,100 Palestinians died during the uprising, and many more were imprisoned or expelled. First Intifada was put down by the Israeli government with so much brutality that the UN condemned Israel for violating the Geneva Conventions. The Intifada succeeded, however, in bringing the Palestinian case to the attention of the world. It also heralded the schizophrenic path the Palestinian resistance would take from now on. While peaceful, non-violent demonstrations were conducted, suicide bombers entered Israel and blew up buses packed with people. The second Intifada began in 2000 and continues until today. So far, it has claimed the lives of over 5,300 Palestinians and over 1,000 Israelis. While it was raging, the only true democratic elections in the whole Arab world took place in the West Bank and Gaza. Frustrated with their corrupt, stagnant government, Palestinians voted for the radical fundamentalist Muslim party of Hamas. Hamas' electoral victory was used by Israel to instigate a worldwide economic embargo against the Palestinians. Also at that time, 10,000 Jewish settlers were evacuated from the Gaza Strip. After the evacuation, the Strip was hermetically sealed and turned into the largest prison on the planet. Israel controls all sea, land, and air access to Gaza. It regularly cuts off all food, water, and power supply to the Strip in order to punish the population for their defiance. In response to bombing by F-16 jets and Apache helicopter gunships targeted assassinations, Palestinians fire homemade rockets at Israeli settlements. Today, Israel continues to steal Palestinian land in order to build more and more settlements. The security wall that Israel erected is instrumental in this, as it encloses a large portion of the West Bank's most fertile land. 3.5 million Palestinians live as virtual prisoners. In the eyes of the Israeli state, they have no basic human rights. Israel kidnaps and imprisons Palestinians on a daily basis. There are over 10,000 Palestinians in Israeli prisons. Men, women, and children are killed almost daily for opposing the occupation. The Israeli state, with its Zionist ideology, won't stop until the last Palestinian living in Palestine is expelled, imprisoned, controlled, or killed. The Palestinians who live in Israel are treated as second-class citizens. They are excluded from the society and are subjugated by racist policies. Generally, the Palestinian opposition takes the form of peaceful, non-violent protests, like in the village of Bilin and Nialin. But from time to time, crime. It also takes the form of suicide attacks when desperate young men, feeling they have nothing to live for, explode themselves in Israeli cities. There is no opposition to Zionism in Israel. There are only small, insignificant groups that remain almost invisible and ignored in Israeli society. And their focus is almost exclusively on the West Bank occupation and the Gaza siege. None of the existing peace organizations in Israel is concerned or even interested in the real causes of the conflict. One of the biggest opposition groups comprises of some 50 anarchists, most of them still in high school. They joined peaceful Palestinian demonstrations in West Bank villages and end up playing cat and mouse with the soldiers pursuing them through the hills. Another group, Gush Shalom, is mainly made up of senior citizens, just like Combatants for Peace and a few other tiny groups. Gush Shalom is not against Zionist policies as a whole. It only specifically protests against the occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza siege. In this situation, it is hard to even determine how positive the impact of those leftist organizations is. After all, their very existence convinces most Israelis and the world that Israel is an open, free, democratic state. The real, desperately needed discussion about the ultimate fate of the remaining Palestinians simply does not exist. All the parties in the Israeli parliament, from right to left, are Zionist. In Israeli society, and increasingly in the outside world, it is only permissible to question the occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza siege. Anyone who questions the occupation of Palestine and the catastrophe Zionism brought on Palestinians is ostracized, silenced, called an anti-Semite, or, in case of a Jew, a self-hating Jew. In terms of racism, there is no difference between apartheid South Africa and Zionist Israel. The Zionists, however, have the biggest weapon that was not available to South Africa apartheid, bigger than F-16s, tanks, and nuclear missiles put together. It's called the Holocaust. The Holocaust allows Zionists to manipulate world public opinion and to stifle any possible open discussion. It is simply their biggest asset. Today, to be an anti-Zionist is construed as being anti-Semitic, and to be anti-Semitic can send you to prison in Europe.
It's used politically in a very effective way, in a very cynical way. I mean, it's very hard to say this, but I think it's true. It's seen as a very useful PR tool. You know, the way the government plays on the guilt in Europe over the Holocaust, so that you can't criticize us. Look what you did to us, you see. It intimidates non-Jews. It closes up discussion. It's very effective. And Israel is willing, for the sake of its PR and to silence critics, it's willing to sell the victims of the Holocaust.
The sad fact is that those 6 million Jews that died because of a fascist, racist ideology are cynically being used today to justify and support another fascist, racist ideology. As most of my family, on both sides, were amongst the victims of the Holocaust, I withdraw my permission from Israeli government and Zionists worldwide to use their death in such a hideous way.
Okay, that gives you some history. All of the jihadists, all the Muslims that are out there busy blowing themselves up, they were taught that. That's not something that is in the Quran. The Jews, these anarchists, these communists that came from Russia, that's what they did, was they blew things up. They blew things up. And unfortunately, the Muslims liked it so much because they had no weapons. First, the English took the weapons away of all the Arabs out there. And there's more history to it than this, and I don't have time for it. But he was talking about, you know, how they control certain things. Well, I want to put your attention on 1871. It's called the Organic Act. That's when the Constitution of the United States was eradicated, a foreign nation was built within the United States, and the Constitution was rebuilt within that foreign nation. That foreign nation is called the District of Columbia. This was done because of the Rothschild and the other Jewish banking families that pretty much owned the debt that the United States had built during the Civil War. So these creatures have been controlling parts of the world for too long, and they're going to continue it, because it's not as if you and I have anything that we can do about it, you know. And I'll tell you something. I'm not going to get into how I know this, I had a conversation with a woman, and a group of men came to her house, her hut. They lived out in the field, and she hid under the floor. And these men came in and raped the three women that were there and then murdered them and left. And they did not speak a language that she'd ever heard. These all spoke Hebrew. And she discovered that years later in talking with me. All communism comes from the Jewish people. And this is a hard thing to say because it's not like all Jews are bad. You have, just like Muslims, you have a volume control knob on them. All the way down to the bottom, they're not even religious. They just, you know, they say, you know, it's awful. I got a big nose and I, you know, it's just, I don't want nothing to do with these idiots at the temple. I want nothing to do with these people. I literally have people who tell me this. We had some good friends, we still do, who are Jewish. And they decided they were supposed to go to Israel to be trained in Israeli forces there and then come back. And all Jews are supposed to do that at least once in their lifetime that come to America. They swear allegiance to Israel, not to America. That's not make-believe. So they went over there, man and woman, and they went over there and they learned all kinds of stuff. And when they came back, he took me aside. He said, I want nothing more to do with those people. They're insane. They're crazy. They hate everyone who isn't Jews. This is ridiculous. And that was it. That was it. That's what he said to me. And I remember being I worked for a guy who was one of the survivors of one of the Auschwitz death camps, and he was a Jew. And he told me, he said, the Jews are their own worst enemy. And I didn't quite understand it. And he spent many times explaining to me about what he meant. And he said, where they go, they bring. And I didn't remember some of the words because he said them in Hebrew, but the word meant collapse. Where they go, they bring collapse with them. Collapse of morals, collapse of the economy, collapse of everything that has to do that with goodness and rightness. And I just thought he was a crazy old man. He was paying me well, you know, so I didn't say anything about that. Go ahead and play clip two.
I believe that Israel has a powerful stranglehold on the American government. Our borders are wide open. You have 300,000 illegal immigrants coming across the border every day. My God, what is the country coming to? And we're guarding the Israeli borders, the Mideast borders. We're in Afghanistan. We're in Pakistan. And our borders are wide open.
You don't make anything better by adding 30 million Mexicans to it, do you? No American would agree with that. And yet no American would stand up in public and say it. And that's a symbol that we're not free. We may be a lot of things, but we're not free. When people are afraid to speak the obvious, you're not free.
The big watershed event in the immigration history until 1965 was the law of 1924. Until that time, America's borders had been pretty open to immigration. Of course, at that time, most of the immigrants came from Europe, but increasingly from Eastern Europe and Southern Europe. And that was creating a problem, you know, because these people were different from the Western European immigrants who had come before, who were assimilating quite easily. And I don't think there was ever going to be a big problem with Italian immigration or Eastern European non-Jewish immigration. Those people were a little more difficult to assimilate, certainly. But the big problem was Jewish immigration. Jewish immigrants came to this country, and they were very, very different from the people who were here before. And the most important difference was that they were deeply committed to these leftist political agendas. If you go over to Eastern Europe at that time, political radicalism was a Jewish subculture. A lot of them were intensely Zionist and so on. There was this hotbed because Jews were under extreme pressure in Eastern Europe. Their populations had expanded. A lot of them were impoverished, and their response to this was to become politically radical. So when they came to this country, they were A, poor, but they were B, politically radical. A lot of them were Zionist. They were extremely intense. These were the people who were organizing all these radical leftist movements. They were revolutionary. They supported the Soviet Union. And Americans were just horrified at this. And beginning, actually early in the 20th century, there was attempts, and even in the 1890s, to shut down immigration. Jewish activist organizations were at the forefront of keeping it open. And of course, their main interest in those years was to get more Jews over from Eastern Europe. So there was a movement in this country to end this free immigration from Europe or elsewhere. And so it came to the head in 1921. They finally passed a law. The purpose of the law really was to create an ethnic status quo. They didn't try to ship the people back. They were already here. But they felt that these people were not assimilating well, and we needed a timeout. And the whole point was to create an ethnic status quo. So the idea in the 1924 law that finally solidified all this was to retain the ethnic proportions that were in the country as of the 1890 census, and then later as of the 1920 census. So the point was to have an ethnic status quo. So the future immigration would be based on what percentage you were of the country as of 1920. This seemed fair to the people who were behind it, but of course Jewish activist organizations rejected this. They wanted more of their people to come over here. They described it as racist and so on. And basically what was going on was that the great majority of the people in the country were finally saying that they had an ethnic interest in preventing future immigration. They wanted the country as it was. They wanted to be a European, Western European culture, that other groups were welcome, and that they would welcome in their contributions. But they did not want to be overwhelmed. They didn't want to lose the culture and the ethnic mix that was characteristic of the country at that time. Of course, Jewish organizations lost this battle. So then, after the 1924 bill passed, Jewish organizations didn't stop trying to change it. Then, in the 1930s, you had the Great Depression, and so it was even harder to change the law because, you know, we're not going to allow millions of people into the country when they're already 25% unemployed. But nevertheless, they kept pushing, especially for Jewish immigrants from Europe, because at that time you had the rise of Hitler, and so they kept trying to change things. But nothing much changed until after World War II, the immigration battles heated up again. The 1952 law that was finally passed basically reaffirmed the 1924 law. It was passed over President Truman's veto. Jewish activist organizations were deeply involved in trying to overturn this legislation. So between 1952 and 1965, they never stopped. They kept creating organizations, funding organizations. Finally, by 1965, with the landslide in 1964, bringing Lyndon Johnson in, the Great Society and all that, the immigration law was finally overturned. All the ethnic quotas that were built into the 1924 law were overturned as racist. It was promised at that time that it wouldn't change the ethnic balance of the country, but certainly in the minds of the activists who were behind it, that was just a ruse. They knew darn well that the attempt really was to change the ethnic balance of the country. And after that law was passed, one of their main goals was to simply increase the ceilings on immigration. In other words, to increase the absolute numbers. Once you got rid of ethnic origins as a criterion, other parts of the world were fair game.
1965, America was about more than 90% white. There are more Americans of Swiss descent in 1960 than a Mexican, edging towards 1 in 9 Americans is a Mexican. Not literally a Mexican national, although there are many of those, but of Mexican descent, and that's a remarkable change in 30 to 40 years.
The reforms in immigration that have completely altered this country have not been the result of popular sentiment. They've been the result, really, of elite sentiment and, frankly, you know, ethnic interest group lobbying and so on. Since 1924, when they lost that, Jews have had a huge animosity towards the culture that did that. Jews, as I said, have it because they see Western culture as fundamentally anti-Jewish, going back to the Middle Ages. They have wanted to essentially end European domination of this society, and I think they're well on the way to doing it.
So when something bad happens, there's a reason. And the reason that the borders are open is that the Jews opened them because they wanted to mix in tens of millions of third worlders because they thought it would be safer for them. They're more safe in a diverse society. That's the reason.
The critical issue is the issue of Jewish power. And by the way, this is not simply Jews. It's the ideology that these Jewish leaders have, and most Jewish organizations have, that they believe that they have a divine right to rule us, to be supreme over us. It's a supremacy. It's not even a separate ideology, or it's not a separatism. It's not an egalitarianism. It is a supremacy position. Judaism, at its root, is a racial supremacist religion. And their power in media, and their power in government today, not only in America, but their influence is great, of course, in England, and it still reaches into other European countries, though it's not as great as it is here. It influences every other issue, whether you're talking about gun control, or whether you're talking about abortion, or whether you're talking about world trade, or whether you're talking about the Iraq War, or whether you're you're talking about affirmative action. This issue is the critical issue, because by controlling our mass media to a great extent, they're able to dictate what happens. By controlling the politicians, they're able to dictate what happens on not just the issues affecting Israel, but many other issues affecting America. For instance, Americans are shocked. A lot of typically conservative Americans who are very much opposed to this mass immigration, which is transforming our nation into a third world country, they are very surprised to learn that immigration, the change in Americans' immigration policy and opening our border, that this policy was almost entirely led and affected by the Jewish supremacists. Almost every Jewish organization for the last 70 years, in fact, it took them 70 years, they started their work to undermine our immigration policy from literally the turn of the 20th century. So starting from around 1900, it took them 65 years. For 65 years, they worked to destroy America's demographic base, to make European Americans into a minority. And of course, in my book, Jewish Supremacism, I quote from many Jewish leaders bragging about the fact that they led this effort. And of course, they not only led it in terms of the actual congressional legislation, they also led it from the standpoint of the media, trying to tell people in America that somehow multiculturalism was a great advantage, that it was going to be a great benefit to people, when we know that so-called multiculturalism leads to greater crime, dislocation, racial insensitivity. In fact, racial tensions arise from it, that a community's sense of brotherhood and togetherness and unity is destroyed by so-called multiculturalism. And when we look around the world and we see multicultural states and multicultural communities, they tend to be far more violent. They tend to be far more disruptive. There's a lot less love and a lot more hate in those kinds of environments because it's human nature. People are different. But anyway, the people who have been the architects of this change have really been Jewish supremacists. So unless we strike at that core ideologically, unless we expose this Jewish supremacist domination over our media and government, we're never going to have any real victories on these other peripheral areas.
The time of the 1965 immigration law is widely stated by Teddy Kennedy and many others that this act would not change the ethnic balance of the country. And yet the very same people who were behind this law immediately, as soon as it was passed, did everything they could to increase the number to the point now where it's about 1 million legal immigrants a year, plus uncounted hundreds of thousands of illegal immigrants.
Chinese, we just recently had some Croatians last summer, and a great number of Brazilians. Jeez, I think from everywhere. And, or, you know, Guatemalans and Salvadorians and Colombians and you name it.
Very interesting to look at what Jewish organizations have done recently. They have allied with Mexican-American groups. They've allied with Asian groups. They've allied with black groups. In other words, they see themselves as part of a coalition of ethnic groups, and very self-consciously so. And those groups are going to become increasingly strong as time goes on because they're representing a greater and greater percentage of the population. But they see themselves, I think, as they have from the time they got here, as opposing the interests of European Americans. I don't think there's any question about that. People opposed to immigration, they talk about, well, there are economic problems and this and that. Nolan simply says, Europeans are not going to benefit from this as a group. We are giving up control of our country to other peoples. That there is a huge problem with this. That when you are a minority group, you better hope that the other groups in society are nice to you. Well, we Europeans should be concerned that our future will be as a minority group, and we will then be at the whim of coalitions that may have very hostile intent towards us. That we will lose control of our own future. That's the issue here. It's as simple as that. But even raising European ethnic interests is the big taboo of this period right now. We can't even raise the possibility that Europeans have ethnic interests. It's the taboo topic. And yet everybody else has ethnic interests, which are legitimate.
The idea that diversity is a strength in mixing people, it's not a strength. The strength comes from the homogeneity and having people who are basically alike. I mean, diverse people break up because they don't want to be around the other people. That's just natural. You don't see diverse species getting together and mingling in nature. You see them avoiding each other or fighting for territory. And the white man knows all this. He doesn't know it at the level of fact, specific understandings, but he senses the spirit of the times. No rational person would open the border with Mexico.
of 100 reasons.
I think that ethnic conflict, we can already see that on the horizon. And I think we're already getting to the point in this country, white people are now 70%. As you get towards 50%, you're going to see increasing amounts of that, where other ethnic groups are simply going to start flexing their muscles, and they're going to demand a greater presence of, say, Spanish in the public place. We're going to see more Spanish spoken in public arenas. We're going to see the decline of Western culture. We're going to see increases in affirmative action directed for underachieving minorities. And I think young white people are going to feel the brunt of this. One of the problems, I think, right now is that most middle-class white people don't feel these pressures. Their children are going to feel them. And I think it's the children who are going to change and start to exert their interest. Because if they don't exert their interest, they're going to be the first group in history that hasn't exerted their interest.
Now, understand, I'm trying to condense all of this as much as I can down, just to give it to people who don't understand what's going on. This is not me saying, this is people who have facts, who have done the study and the research. Now, there is a girl that put a YouTube video up, and she's done quite a bit of research and has all kinds to back up. This gives me some hope that the young are starting to see through the wool that's been pulled over everybody's face for so long. Go ahead and play cut four.
I am a realist. When I look at the world, I notice that obviously we do not live in a utopia. There are so many problems that we face today, such as the migrant crisis, feminism, illegal immigration, political correctness, crime, poor education, white guilt, high unemployment rates, and usury. From my extensive research, which started when I was 10 years old, I found that behind every major problem that we face today, you will find Jewish people. I don't want you to just take my word for this very important conclusion. I want you guys to study the facts for yourself. Turn on your brain, think about the evidence, and reach your own conclusion. I want you guys to overcome your fear of being called a Nazi or anti-Semite. Leave your safe space and examine the evidence objectively. So let's back up a bit and just ask ourselves, what is the single most powerful and influential institution today? What institution more than any other is promoting the worst and most destructive trends? And who controls that institution? The media is the most powerful institution at the moment. When I say media, I'm talking about the news and entertainment industry. The media pumps out propaganda to shape the public's ideas and opinions. So who controls this media? Four of the big six media corporations, Comcast, Disney, News Corp, Time Warner, Viacom, and CBS, are entirely led by Jews such as Murray Rothstein, who now calls himself Summer Redstone, David L. Cohen, Bob Iger, Leslie Moonovs, and so on. They are also involved with the other two, but they do not outright control them. Together, these big six control over 90% of U.S. news and entertainment media. And although print media is dying because of television and the internet, Jewish newspapers like the New York Times are still very influential. It's not just the men at the top who are Jews. These media giants are staffed by Jews from top to bottom. There are people out there who think this is just a mere coincidence, but some Jews like Joel Stein in the LA Times have enough chutzpah to openly brag about controlling the media. This is no secret. Even Marlo Brando came out and said it.
Are you critical of the Hollywood that makes violence?
I think that I'm angry with some of the Jews. I'm very goddamn angry at some of the Jews. Hollywood is run by Jews. It's owned by Jews. They should have a greater sensitivity about the issue of people who are suffering.
The media has been successful in pushing many destructive agendas, such as the LGBT agenda. The whole purpose of the LGBT agenda was to promote the degenerate gay lifestyle. Over the last 40 years, they have shifted the public views of homosexuality from disgust to celebration through the countless movies, TV shows, books, and plays with gay characters. The media has successfully desensitized the population to allow such degeneracy that was once seen as immoral to be encouraged. Jews like Suzanne Salkind and Michael Schwartz are associate directors for the LGBT lobby group, Human Rights Campaign. Unsurprisingly, the leaders behind the LGBT and the most prominent homosexuals are Jews, such as Allen Ginsberg and Leslie Feinberg, who is a transgender, butch, lesbian, activist, communist, and author. What a wonderful combination. Also, the biggest gay porn company in the world, Lucas Entertainment, is owned by Jews. The next degenerate thing they are normalizing is pedophilia. Already we see organizations like NAMBLA, which is led by the pedo Jew David Thorstad. The left-wing website Salon recently released this article titled, I'm a pedophile, but I'm not a monster, which is obviously a propaganda piece to make people reconsider their disgust and hatred towards pedos. Jews have always been interested in pedophilia. In fact, the Babylonian Talmud has some very pro-pedophilic verses. In Yabamoth 60b, the Talmud says, a proselyte who is under the age of 3 years and 1 day is permitted to marry a priest. I could go on about the disgusting Talmud verses, but that's a video for another day. For now, I want to focus on the Jewish influence in our media, society, and culture. The media also promotes pro-refugee propaganda to appeal to the emotions of the feminists and cucks. So they hold up refugee welcome signs and not resist the invasion of their homeland. Because the media demonizes anyone seen as Islamophobic, feminists refuse to speak up against the rape epidemic, even though it's a legitimate feminist issue. Some feminists, like this cuck, even felt bad that his Syrian migrant rapist got deported. Jews like Barbara Spector even came out and said that Jews are the ones pushing multiculturalism. Another very powerful institution that is responsible for shaping the opinions and thoughts of the public is the education system. The motto of Yale University is literally in Hebrew. Jews donate huge grants to the Ivy League schools and place Jewish personnel in high positions, such as David Skorton, who is the president of Cornell, and Alan Garber, who is the provost of Harvard. Also, Jews get into colleges and universities easier than all the other races. Just look at Harvard. Jews are 1.8% of college-age Americans, and they are given 25% of the admissions. The American Federation of Teachers is run by Jews, and the ADL has infiltrated the public schools, brainwashing young children with books and lessons to support Jewish interests. Also, the ADL develops software to stop children from seeing any problematic hate speech over the internet. And by hate speech, we know they mean facts that make Jews look bad. So they would probably block this video. The school curriculum does have a very prominent bias towards Jewish interests. After all, kids are taught about the Holocaust here as young as grade 3. Yet they won't teach you that Jews were removed from 109 countries throughout history. The Jews have taken over the internet and use it to their advantage to push agendas as well. Let's look at the three most popular websites that you guys probably use every day. The founder and CEO of Facebook is the Jew Mark Zuckerberg. Facebook COO is Sheryl Sandberg. She is not Mexican, she's a Jew. The founders and CEOs of Google are the Jews Larry Page and Sergey Brin. And you know, Google owns YouTube, Blogger, Android, and a lot more. The CEO of YouTube is Susan Wojcicki, and she's a Jew too. I hope this video doesn't get showed by her. Oy vey! But if it does, well, I have it saved and I'll re-upload it somewhere else, so don't worry. When we look at the most destructive policies in the last 50 years, we see that Jews were behind those as well. Look at the American 1965 Immigration Act that shifted the flow of immigrants into this country from mostly Europeans to mostly non-whites. It was proposed by the Jew Emanuel Seller and pushed by Jews like Jacob Javits and Norbert Shkeli. Also, Jews have been pushing gun control since the 1960s as well. The Gun Control Act of 1968 expanded legislation already attempted by the non-Jewish Senator Thomas Dodd. America's biggest and most far-reaching gun law came from a Jew. In 1988, Jew Senator Howard Metzenbaum co-sponsored a bill to ban, limit, and restrict so-called plastic guns. The Jews have their paws deep into our government and banking system. The Federal Reserve is run by the Jew Janet Yellen. Before her, it was run by the Jew Ben Salom Bernanke, and before him, it was run by the Jew Alan Greenspan. By now, everyone should know about the destructive nature of our current debt-based financial system. So what about the time Israel killed 34 Americans and tried to blame it on Egypt in order to get the US involved in a war with Egypt? Did we bomb Tel Aviv the same way we bombed Baghdad and so many other cities? Did we impose an embargo on Israel, starving 500 Jewish children to death like we did in Iraq?
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. You know, is the price worth it?
We think the price is worth it.
Nope. Instead, we help them cover up the incident. Somebody in the comments is probably going to say that it's not the Jews in particular who are destroying our civilization. It's the greedy rich people of all races. Those billionaires opened our borders to the third world for cheap slave labor. It's the lawyers of all races who run our legislatures. and our courts to enrich themselves rather than give us good laws and justice. Most lawyers choose their profession because they see it as a way to gain personal wealth and power. The people who tell me this are not entirely incorrect. I used to believe this too, but they need to look at the bigger picture. The following is an analogy by Dr. Pierce, which pretty much explains the Jewish problem very well.
You must back off a bit in order to see the forest rather than just the trees. The essential thing about the forest is that it is destroying our world. It is a parasitic forest. It is injecting spiritual and cultural poison into our civilization and into the life of our people and sucking up nutrients to enrich itself and grow even more destructive. Perhaps only 10% of the trees in this Jewish forest have roots deep enough to inject their poison into us, and the other 90% play only supporting roles of one sort or another. It is still the whole forest which is our problem. If the forest were not here, we would not have had to endure the curse of Bolshevism. If the forest were not here, America would not be growing darker and more degenerate by the year. It is the whole forest, not just a few of the most poisonous trees in it, which must be uprooted and removed from our soil if we are to become healthy again.
To learn who rules over you, simply look at who you're not allowed to criticize. Christian fundamentalists like to say that Jews are God's chosen people, therefore we should protect them. But it's not only Christian fundamentalists who defend Jews. The Jews have created many Jewish-controlled organizations like the ADL, SBLC, and the Simon Wiesenthal Center to make sure Jews have a giant safe space in America. Why don't we have any organizations like this defending white people in particular? Oh, that's right, because if white people defend themselves, they are racist. These Jewish organizations have a history of collecting huge donations from wealthy Jews for filing lawsuits against dissident groups which fought against the PC. I don't think anybody should have a safe space, honestly. I believe there should be no protected groups of people. Understanding the Jewish people is clearly key to understanding many other things, since they have so much influence in our world. But let's look at history to understand how they climbed up the ladder to get where they are today. While researching the history of the Jews, I always wondered why the Jews were always picked on and persecuted, far more than any other group. Why did everyone else hate them? They couldn't have all been just stupid bigots. Jews have literally been kicked out of virtually every country in Europe during the last 1,000 years. They were booted out of England and Spain and Portugal and France and Sweden and Germany and 12 other countries. They were told never to come back, just so they could sneak back in and get kicked out again. The Jews like to say it was Christian bigotry, but Christian bigotry cannot explain why the Egyptians threw them out of Egypt, and it cannot explain why the pagan Greeks and Romans hated them too. Perhaps the socially and racially destructive activities of the Jews were planned and deliberate. This probably doesn't make much sense to you guys, since it's a lot to take in. You're probably wondering why the Jews deliberately seek to destroy a great society. Why can't they just live on and be happy like the other citizens? To answer your question, we must try to understand the unique nature of the Jew. At some time far back in the prehistoric period, certainly more than 3,000 years ago, the Jews developed a unique mode of survival as predators and parasites. Whereas other races, other tribes sought to either live peacefully among their own kind or to conquer other tribes militarily and take their land or require them to pay tribute. The Jews sought to invade territory of other races by stealth and subvert them, to break down the order and structure in their societies, to control them and exploit them. There's even evidence of the Jews doing this back in biblical times. In the fourth book of Moses, chapter 33, it stands written, "And the Lord Yahweh talked to Moses in the domains of the Moabiter, near Jordan. And he spoke, 'When you have crossed to Jordan into the land of Canaan, you shall expel all inhabitants and destroy their altars and shrines on the heights, so that you could take the land and reside in it. You should divide the land through lottery among your families.'" In the beginning, thousands of years ago, this may have only been a novel plan of gaining control of a particular neighbor, but eventually, it developed into a way of life. It became part of their culture, their religion. The nations of the past who removed the parasitic Jew did so because of their instincts. The Jew was a parasite because of his own instincts. And, as I said before, you do need to think very carefully about this. You need to study the fact and come up with your own conclusion. It's difficult for many people to understand the Jews because they can't relate to them. They are really such a unique ethnic group. I find it very difficult to sum up my thoughts on the Jews in a comprehensible manner. I went to school with Jews. I even lived with a Jewish family friend for a little while, so I have had a lot of experience with Jewish people and culture. I don't believe that every single Jew is promoting evil, but it is very clear to me that although people argue because Jews cured polio and have so many Nobel Prizes, they contribute more positive things to our society than negatives. The Jews bring with them a unique destructive force. And you know, there are evil people in every race, but there is no race that is as destructive.
And that is the only show that YouTube ever took off of mine. And it's funny, you can go on YouTube and you can find worse shows than that that are still on there and have been for years. Now, where was I for 2 weeks? I've been in communication with a lot of different people all over the world. Years ago, I founded the Stanislaus County Militia. We had almost 3,000 members. I was an informational officer for the U.S. militias. I got, you know, all the rumors you ever hear about, all of the right-wing conspiratorial FEMA camp stuff you have ever heard about, they were all real because I discovered them all. And I had video proof, I had photographic proof, and I have all kinds of meetings, covert meetings with other informational officers. These people that I've worked with for years, and I haven't worked with them for 20 years, but I was contacted and I was asked that to have a communication with them. Now, these are all retired. They're not active duty. These are from Australian Security Intelligence. This is Canadian Security Intelligence. Hong Kong Police Force, the CBI of India, the Mossad, National Intelligence Coordinating Agency in the Philippines, Federal Security Service in Russia, that's the FSB, CIA, FBI, NSA, and Army Intelligence. These are the people that I met with. Some I met with in person, some I've met with on radio or Skype or telephone. And basically what these people do is they know each other, they're a think tank, and they put together data that they think is coming down the pike. And basically I got some information. And it goes back to 1820, and this is, and again, I mentioned at the beginning of the show, if you'd listened to my show, you'd have all this data and you could put it all together. The Democratic Party was formed in 1820 by the Illuminati. 95% of the Illuminati is Jewish. Now, I could be wrong, it could be 100%. I just know that 95% of them are Jewish, and they had three long-term goals. The Illuminati works against America. There's other agencies and organizations that handle the rest of the world, so they're only concerned about us. So they created the Democratic Party with three goals. One, create as many voters in a victim class as possible. Now, this is a plan. This is a long-term plan. Number two, position the Democratic Party as their saviors and protectors. You got that? Three, position any and all opposition as the enemy of the victims. And I have a synopsis of various victim classes. And it's not cut and dried. Blacks, Latinos, Asians, and you see that now. The communists are pushing hard on Asian hate. And according to the FBI statistics, there is no Asian hate. You want Asian hate crimes? They're all committed by blacks. Not one has been committed by a Mexican, Latino, a white, or anything else. The other victim classes are women, sexual perverts, drug and alcohol abusers. Okay, now, they've arrived, and this is the conclusion from all of these people. And this conclusion was, don't get me wrong, it's not apathetic. This is a fact. This is reality. This is what has happened. The Democratic Party is one. Now, the Democratic Party, the Illuminati, they became communistic, even taking on the mantle of communism. Here's what they used to achieve all of this. They used communism. Communism was created by Russian Jews. Everything I say, you can go verify yourself. I'm not going to do it anymore. I'm not going to verify what I'm saying today because I already have. Everything I say, I've already said before. Communism was created by certain Jews. Now, understand this. I'm not saying all Jews are bad. That's as stupid as saying all blacks are bad. In communication with other Jews, that I was told, there are tribes of Jews. One of the tribes is considered evil. And I think this is the tribe that's been doing all of this. Obviously, people like George Soros are part of that tribe. But so the Jews created communism. The Jews also created something else, another evil, called psychiatry. Psychiatry was created, and this is, we're talking Russian Jews did this. psychiatry was created to develop a means of controlling the population, and that's what psychiatry is. They also, another tool used was the public schools, where they put the whole concept of communism into it. The ACLU is another tool. Television is one of the tools. Radio, print media, internet, these are all their tools. The internet now has become the new communistic censorship. It's the same thing that occurred in Russia and China, and even before there was television, they did the censoring. Now, the parts that are 100% controlled by Jews, movies, all movie studios, TV stations, magazines, newspapers, radio networks, various internet services like Google and YouTube and all of this kind of stuff. Anywhere you hear the term mental health, that's controlled by Jews. Also, what is controlled 100% by Jews are inoculations and vaccinations. That should give you an idea of where we're at today. You will find these people at the head of the snake of every one of these things I said. And the whole intent. Now, the guy that I worked for that was a survivor of one of the Auschwitz camps, he told me, he said, what the Jews, the concept is that, because I asked him, I said, I don't understand, how come there's so many Jews that are anti-gun? He said, look, how they work is this. They feel that if they can make everybody around them weak and defenseless, then they won't ever attack them again. So that's how these Jews do. They destroy everything around them so that they feel safer. The whole goal of all of this is the eradication of societal morals and ethics. Now, this is the thing that got me, because when they were finished telling me all of the rest of this stuff, they told me this part. And I realized, and they explained this to me, it's not just America that this is occurring. This is every place on Earth. They eradicate the societal morals and ethics. These are the morals and ethics that created that society. It could be African, it could be New Zealand, it could be Australian, it could be America. They destroy birth rate among whites. Now, remember, the white race are the colonizers. These are the ones that civilized nations. So the whites have to be destroyed. They destroy the birth rate. And how do they do that? Two things. Feminism and all of this gender confusion crap. This is an actual physiological test that can be done, and it shows that the sperm count is dropping down in societies where women vote, where women are in charge of things, where feminism has taken over. I'm not evaluating whether it's good or bad. I'm just saying this is real. And then when you there's 142 genders, which is all horse crap, men get a little, let's just say it, the penis pucker up. And that's the same thing that's happening. So they destroy the birth rate among whites. They have to eradicate Christianity. They weaken military, both effectiveness and morale. And you can see that easily. It's our military, all of the branches, is a laughingstock worldwide. The goal, again, these are goals. They want the view that the victim classes are more valuable, deserving, and moral than whites. The key is the destruction of whites and the invalidation of whites. They want to reduce the actual physical population of whites, not necessarily by killing them off, but by an influx of victim classes. And again, we go back to the victim class, which are blacks, Latinos, Asians, women, sexual perverts, drug and alcohol abusers. So right now, the communists that are in charge of the United States, don't be confused. They're not going to hold up a sign that says communist. They're called Democrats. They're bringing in hundreds of thousands of Muslims and Latinos, Mexicans. And basically the whole concept and the whole intent, and this is happening all over the world, the whole intent is to weaken the population's ability and willingness to maintain national sovereignty. And that causes us to become easier to control. You can see it in my travels. I can see the control. We went through Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, Texas, California, Oregon, Washington, Everywhere I went, people that were using masks were walking hunched forward. Everywhere. People without masks were standing up straight. When I first saw that, I said, that's got to be just coincidental. Every state. And I mentioned New Mexico. New Mexico, the whole state is a victim class because it's Indians. And again, I'm not going to say anything about the Indians one way or the other because I was raised on the Indian reservation, Klamath Indian Reservation. Klamath and the Hopi are totally different than any of the other Indians. They've been cowed by the federal government. Their ability to create and to be individuals has been stripped from them. So they are now grasping at victim status. And it's easier to be a victim. It really is. It's easy to be a victim, and that's exactly what's happening worldwide. You're finding victims all over the place. But the key that I'm talking about here is apparently there is, speaking of classes, there is a class of Jews that is openly and actively doing everything possible for the destruction of all civilized countries. We can see it here in the United States. Dimwit's group that of people that he has hired into his inner circle are all Jews. And when I say Jew, I don't just mean Jew. I mean they have dual citizenship. When you are a citizen of Israel, you have to swear allegiance to Israel above America. And they do. Now, don't get me wrong either. They're not all Democrats. There are plenty of Jewish Republicans that do the exact same thing. See, it's best to have your agents on both sides of the aisle. That way it confuses people who are doing the investigations. I have never done any investigation into the Jewish population and the tribes and all of that stuff. I have heard all kinds of oddball stuff. I don't even care. But it's getting to the point now where we are finding out. And this group that I've talked to and met with in the past 2 weeks, it is the strangest thing to listen to them talk, because they all have come up with the same exact concept of failure. We failed. This is what it's like. And they can't find a solution. The only solution, they have like half a dozen solutions. Number one is civil war. Number two is genetic cleansing. These are things that are not necessarily going to happen. Number three is an asteroid hit. Number four is World War III or four, depends on if you think we're in number three already. So there are cataclysmic events that the only thing they feel are going to change any of this. And are they going to work towards that? No, that's not their job anymore. All of their job. Now, again, I'm talking to intelligence agents, so I can't guarantee that they're all telling me the truth. I can't guarantee that they're not retired. I just have known most of them for 30, 40 years. And their idea is that what has been occurring for the past 100 years is going nowhere but worse, because the only population on Earth that had a chance at defending against them has been infiltrated and diluted starting in 1905 with the creation of the public school system by the Jews. And now we have people who graduate high school can't read the diploma. We have people who have to get specialized training so they can give change back at McDonald's. We have people who become morbidly obese, change their hair color to pink, become lesbian, and claim that the white man destroyed everything. This is all this insanity, and that's what this breed of Jews is doing, is creating the insanity in the world. And anybody who's not insane is told to their face, you're insane, because you don't grasp how to be tolerant. You don't understand the idea of acceptance. You just don't get the idea that it's changing. Well, that's you hear that a lot. Oh, no, it's not your world anymore. It's our world now. Except it's never been our world. It's never been their world. It's these people who are controlling everything, these people who are creating all of the facades. So I don't know what the answer is. They don't know what the answer is. They're not concerned about it. It's a joke to them. They say, well, we're so old now. We're going to die before there's a solution. My simple solution is that everybody has to make sure that they know what they're doing. Everybody has to be prepared. Everybody has to be ready, willing, and able to do what has to be done for their survival, their family's survival, the group survival. The society at large is on its own. You know, I hate to sound prophetic or apathetic, but that's why I was gone for 2 weeks. I got all this information, and we'll see what you do with it. So this is the Armchair Survivalist. SurvivalEnterprises.com, SE1.us. You want me to hang around here anymore? And then you're going to have to buy stuff from my company, because if you don't, I can't afford to be on the air. I'll have to go get a real job somewhere. I'm sure there's more I could say, but basically, this is the Armchair Survivalist signing off. Keep your nose in the air and your ear to the ground. And I'll see you next week.